What's happening in the canine industry? For all the latest news, views, and expert opinions, stay right here for the Canine Paradigm. You'll hear from industry leaders, experts, doyens of the industry, learned colleagues, movers and shakers, and the odd randy guest. Get the latest insights and expert advice from both here and abroad from the people in the know. Now, here are your hosts, Glenn Cook and Pat Stewart. And I'm Lofty Fulton, and I'm out of here.
Hey, I need to tell you something.
Oh, God, what is it?
Some time ago, we did an ad episode where we talked about how we were going to get better with our ads.
I was wondering where you were going. Yeah. We're so shit at the ads. That's what we said.
We said, we're so shit, we're going to get better, and we just didn't.
We don't. We're so full of shit.
All right, well, here they are. We got five sponsors currently.
All right, who are they?
First is the OG. The Ian Zawina.
Oh, that knob.
The buffhead.
Yeah.
Nah, he's the OG. He's been with us since the start.
No, he's good.
He's going to sell you whatever you need.
Yep.
He'll get it. What you should do is contact Jason from Ironswick Dog Queer with some peculiar product, tell him you want it, and make him get it in and sell it to you. Even if you could buy it somewhere else, just make sure he gets it in for you.
Just make that bastard work.
But in all honesty, I'd say 90% of my shit comes from him, and it's all the best stuff.
I did see some feedback on our forum where somebody was really intrigued about your handler package, the one that you got from Jason. Obviously, it works.
Like, yeah,
people are paying attention to the ads. That's great. Even though we're shit at this, we do a terrible job of actually trying to keep things updated. It's great to see that the people who are investing in our show are actually getting some leeway.
Yep. Mate, I've heard that your wife sells some canine products.
My wife is doing great guns at the moment. I said before that she's been supported terrifically in the United States, which has been good, but I will swing that back home and say that so many more people in Australia are doing it. And it's great to see, like, there are people finally in the sporting dog world who are starting to prioritize nutrition for their dogs. And I know them. I can see them when Narelle comes in and says, oh, guess who bought some product off me for the first time.
So, are you saying there's no patient confidentiality?
No, there's patient confidentiality.
Oh, sorry.
It's just a mailing list.
Confidentiality.
What's a mailing list?
Are you aware my dog is taking pee, collagen, and what's the other thing he takes?
Antinol.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been on that.
Antinol is not Narelle's business, but I've got to do a shout out for Antinol. They are absolutely fantastic. They're very supportive of our show.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we've done seminars and so forth, they have been first to dip their hand in their pocket. They are very generous with their product. But let me just say, all that aside, their generosity and their advertising and marketing, let me just say, on the other side of that, their product is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it does work. It's very beneficial.
For sure.
It's one of those things where they say Antinol for every dog every day. I totally agree with that. Narelle has even supported that. When people have asked them about her product, she says, the two things that I would absolutely give to you is Antinol and her Gut Protect formula.
Yeah, right.
Gut Protect is like her holy grail of
like
her whole range.
Flagship of the range.
This is not me market talking, okay?
Because
we are.
This is an ad.
This is an ad, but this is not me doing marketing.
But we've already pointed out we're shit at ads.
I know. Of all the things that she sells, and she sells some killer product, but the one thing that she does sell, which I absolutely agree with her, every dog should have this product, is the Gut Protect.
Really?
100%. It's nothing that they need for being sick. It's something that they need to do just to maintain great gut balance.
Okay.
And gut balance is like mental health. It's one of those things that you absolutely want to get control around. So products like Antinol, great for every day. Gut Protect, great for every day. There's other products that aren't even related to hers called things like Rosehip Vital and stuff like that. Absolutely fantastic for dogs to be on every sort of day.
Mm.
But I know there's other people we need to talk about. If you want to learn more about Narelle's products, go to our website, canineceuticals.com. I think it's
just, you'll figure it out.
It's .com or .com.au. It's one of those.
No one types that shit anyway. Everyone just Googles it. And
yeah,
then
just Google it. You'll find it.
Hey.
Yeah.
George Kittredge. I reckon we should get him on the show.
We should have George Kittredge on the show. Yeah. Not only is he devilishly handsome, but he's got a fantastic, one-of-a-kind product that I've never seen replicated anywhere in the world. You and me were getting a car ride by him. We got to see the prototype firsthand. Yep.
And then his bike got stolen with the prototype on it.
It did.
Remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, George has Rowdy Hound Dog Box. And so it's a crate that goes on the back of your motorbike so that your dog can go everywhere with you.
Yeah.
And it's cool as shit. It's a great idea. You should totally get one. Tailored Canines in Canada.
Yeah.
Do you know that Taylor from Tailored Canines is hosting Jazz Whiting later in the year?
I do know that. Yes, I saw the ad. Very good.
Yep.
Not only is she doing great stuff with her Tailored Canine.
Her training business.
Her training business, but she's also getting a fantastic trainer over there to help with her tailored training.
She is. And finally, Barbara de Groot,
The sugar mama from the heart dog training.
From the heart dog training.
Just fucking throws cash at us.
Just supports the show. God bless
her. Yeah. I think later on the year when Narelle and I are over doing a seminar with Melanie Benware, Barbara De Groot is coming over.
Wonderful.
I think she has put down a like and I said, you better come, sugar mama, and she gave me a thumbs up. So hopefully she's going to be there and I can give her some love to repay us for all the kindness and support that she's thrown at us and ask nothing in return.
All right. That's our ad.
Yeah.
That one's good to go for at least another 4 years. You'll hear from us then. Welcome back to the Canine Paradigm. I'm your host, Pat Stewart. I'm joined in the studio today by my co-host, Glenn Cook.
In the studio.
We are. In the spare room of your home.
The middle room.
The middle room.
It's the transit room.
The pass-through.
It is the pass-through room.
Anyway, we're here. We're doing it.
Lots of people have been in this pass-through room.
They have. They've passed through.
Yeah. I've still tried to make sure that we keep some of the essence of Michael Ellis around. Who is coming back?
Oh, yeah.
He's coming back to Australia. He will be here end August and September. It's about to be officially notified, but the man is coming back, so get ready.
My goodness, how exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Where's he going?
Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane.
All right, so all three.
All three.
Cool.
So by the time this comes out, I would say Alex and I will have it posted up. If not, I've ruined the surprise for Alex. No, but look, we're ready to announce anyway. It's happening. We've been backwards and forwards on Zoom calls and talking about topics and all the fun we're going to have while he's here. So looking forward to seeing a very beloved personality back here, Mr. Michael Ellis.
Yeah, that will be fun.
It will be.
We should do the thing that we discussed with him. We should put that into motion.
Yes. I think that's a good idea. And we're not going to talk about it here because it's going to be a pretty big surprise.
Cool thing.
Yeah, cool thing.
All right. Hey, we've been working through, we asked people for questions and considering they're just, a lot of them are one line answers, but we've been turning that into 20 minute debates and conversations. We're not very far into it. So we could just keep continuing.
You know who gets upset at me about that?
Who?
Carnelian.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Because she says, if you talk less, you'd get through more topics.
Well, the show is just us talking.
Just shut the fuck up.
Jesus. Gosh. All right. Well, let's carry on. So there's a question here from Rosa Witt Rosa.
Hi, Rosa. Hi, yeah. Rosa.
What is the best way to create connection and play with a dog outside of the home if the dog has good engagement and play inside, but as soon as they walk out the door is like the owner doesn't exist? Dog is reactive to other dogs and squirrels.
That's a really good question. That was a big topic of conversation when I was teaching in NDTF.
Mm-hmm.
We would talk about this type of thing all the time because a lot of times when we're introducing any new behavior to a dog, teaching phase / learning phase, we're showing a dog how to perform the very basics of an exercise. Like it is incremental work, the very, very basics of everything. It's the same thing with us when we're learning anything new. Every time you, me, and anybody else I know who's learned to drive, play an instrument, assemble something, we've had to learn from the very, very basics and then build ourselves up from there. We always talked about the concept of limiting how much distraction or how much arousal was around you at that time, primarily creating yourself a suitable Skinner box.
Mm-hmm.
So the dog could concentrate on what you and it were doing. The arousal levels that the dog had was for the food that you had at the time. It's usually food. Let's stick around the food rather than the play or the ball thing at this point in time. But we'd usually have some suitable, attractive food for the dog and the dog would be suitably aroused by that. We'd get a level of interest in the dog that would be suitable for what we're doing and then we could go ahead and start shaping a behavior. Leading up to the dog bypassing successfully teaching / learning phase and then moving into the training phase where the dog is now operantly minded. Now I know what to do. Now I know that I've got a cue attached to it. And now I know that there are consequences both for doing it or not doing it. Then we would start progressing into a proofing phase, so to speak, where the dog is still in that environment. We're not rushing it through. We're incrementally pacing our way through, teaching the dog how to learn, how to become successful in this exercise. So now we've got the dog that understands, let's talk a simple basic exercise such as sit. We've got the dog understanding if I'm in this environment and I hear the word sit, nothing is happening at this point in time to distract me from doing it. I also understand that because of the coaching you've given me, put my bum on the ground and wait there until you've released from me from the position.
Mm-hmm.
So generally like a marker or something like that. So yes, or a clicker. The dog gets up, comes over, gets a treat from you. Everything's going really well. Everyone's happy. The dog's doing beautiful sits. You could even say that the dog is classically minded now. It doesn't struggle with the concept of thinking about other things when the concept is introduced of sitting. It just goes, yep, this is what I must do. So it plants its ass on the ground. Now we're talking about changing locations. The immediate time you're doing that, you're now shifting phases with the dog. You're now no longer in a proofing phase with the dog. And where that question came up, which is why I said this was at the topic of great debate with people, is the minute that you take the dog into a different environment, now you're introducing outside influences on the dog. There's other things to become aroused in. There's other things to become interested in. Sure, you should limit how much that is introduced to the dog at that point in time. Like taking it out and making the arousal so overwhelming would be ridiculous. Like that's insane to do something like that. So always the suggestion was from any of the people that I've worked under, any of the coaches I've worked in life, is always moderate it and always incrementally upscale it so you can set your student up for success along the pathway. Perfect, no problem. You take the dog out, there's a moderate amount of arousal out there, but nothing that's competing so much. The dog goes, I kind of want to go over there, but I still want to do this sit thing for you. So I do it, I'm successful, I get paid. This is great, I'm loving it. Where people make the mistake is they're doing the former. They're taking the dog out. The dog is in such a heavily reinforced environment. There's so many other competing levels of arousal out there that the dog's almost in nirvana. Like it thinks to itself, well, I've got a selection of this or that or this or that or whatever it may be. You know, like I can look at the squirrel, I can look at the cricket, or I can look at that interesting leaf blowing on the ground because they're not usually in my initial environment, but now they are. Mm-hmm. And I want them because this other stuff was fun while we were doing it in there, but this stuff is fun now. Yeah, I like the food and I'm into it and so forth, but I can forego that for the moment because this stuff is fun. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm not teaching you this, like conversation. But this is where people fundamentally go wrong, is they throw the dog out there. The dog's head is divided with its loyalties and with its educations. So now it's thinking, well, yeah, we've been doing that, but I want all this stuff. Like this stuff is great and I want to be a part of this. Then you're in a mind where you think, well, no, you know how to do this and you shouldn't be doing it. So you're trying to punish everything away. So it sort of betrays that level of trust or even the education that the dog has, because the dog now doesn't have outside education, it has inside education. Mm-hmm. All of this has been a big lead up for me saying the issue is that you haven't transitioned from inside to outside or from one isolative Skinner environment into a new environment that has all these pockets of arousal. You haven't transitioned properly. And that's your issue. That's where you're going wrong. And that's why generally you start seeing these fundamental problems rising in the behavior because you've increased the loudness and the level of what's happening too soon.
Mm, yeah, I agree. I think of it in terms, for me, most of the plus R side of dog training is about motivational math.
Yep.
So the dog's just drawn to things that it wants, yeah, right? And dogs don't think too much about how are you going to see this. They just live in the moment. They want what they want. They go after what is attractive to them. And so I think what the circumstance that Rosa explains, where the dog will play in the house but won't play outside because for whatever reason. And she says that the dog's reactive to other dogs and squirrels. But what that really means is that the draw, like I think of it in terms of like a magnet, right, to the game that the person is playing, there's a pull, right? There's a certain level of attraction to that because you are getting it. It does exist within the home. But then when you change the environment, you go outside, now those other dogs, the squirrels, whatever, there's a bigger draw. And so the turn just goes to them. And so the trick to being able to take that gameplay everywhere you want it to go is to first of all get really good at it where it works. I think that's one of the things that we sort of overlook, is getting really good when in the whatever the environment is that the dog can play.
Yeah, you've got to get to a proofing phase. You've got to get to that stage first where you, like you have created that strength and that reliability and that lack of the dog questioning whether I should do it or not.
Yeah.
Where the dog is primarily classical at that point where the dog says, yeah, I'm doing it.
Yeah, I'm in.
I'm in.
Right. And
you son of a bitch, I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. And the proofing phase for just play then ends up being making the game a little bit spicy, right? So I think this is one of the things. So when people are playing in their home, they're seldom even going to have a leash on the dog, right? Mm. So it truly is just a game of all positive reinforcement, and that can get kind of boring pretty quickly, depending on the type of dog. Like if the dog's very possessive or the dog does enjoy to fight, then you're going to have more success. But if you're not getting that success out of the home, then you probably don't have that, right? Mm. Like you don't have that kind of dog. And so very few people are going to attach a leash to the dog in their home just to play a game of tug. And without that leash, you don't have any way of proofing that the dog needs to come and re-engage. And so a big part of the way that I'd play, you know, with a dog is that, yep, we have the game of tug, and people sometimes forget that that's a game where you're trying to win. You know, how often do you see people that the dog's kind of only into it and they're more into it than the dog is, and they're basically hitting the dog in the face with the tug and making the dog less into it as they're trying to bring the dog into it. And they forget that the game is to try and take it from each other, not you to try and give it to the dog, right? Like that's not a game. That's a different thing altogether. And so
it's a request.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's more work, right? Yeah. And then people try and use that type of play as a reinforcer, and you're essentially attempting to reinforce work with more work.
Mm.
So what I would suggest is that you play with the dog in the home in a way that gets a little bit more spicy for the dog, and therefore the dog will enjoy it much more. A game with consequences, a game where you can win and a game where you can lose. So that means, you know, actually playing more rambunctiously where the dog has to really put into play. Let the dog win when it does something that impresses you. Let the dog win the equipment, not just because it's holding the equipment, but because it does something by kicking up a notch and it learns to commit more. And then when you win, there has to be some kind of consequence for that loss. And usually, like to me, this is just, you know, this could be leash on a flat collar, doesn't matter, but there's some kind of like the dog has to be able to pursue. Like I'm sometimes like, we'll pop the dog back into the toy.
Mm.
Or if I manage to steal the toy whilst I'm running away, still with the toy in a presentation so the dog can strike it when it gets there, but I'm leaving quickly. And if I get to the length of the leash, then the dog gets put under a small amount of pressure. It's just the leash going tight on their flat collar that they have to then attempt to relieve by closing that distance. And so the game now has two layers. It means that yes, you can win the thing and you can bite it, you can tug it, we can fight with it, but you can also lose. And so when you lose, there's a consequence for that. You get to observe me as the winner. You have to watch me parade, but you can interrupt that parade and turn off the like small pop, the negative reinforcement, if we're going to call it that, to re-engage with me and steal the toy. And so when you have that in the home, now that popping of the collar back into the toy is the proofing that you were talking about, and that you can now proof the dog back into it. So, and I think as well, a big part of these sorts of transitions is playing through the threshold. I think very few people realize the power. We always talk about it and it's known in the dog training world, but I think the way that people have talked about thresholds in the past has led people to think, well, that's bullshit. So therefore thresholds aren't as important a thing as they probably are to dogs. So, you know, the old school, we talked about, I think it was an episode or two ago, where the old school dominance theory sort of dog training was never let the dog walk through the door before you and stuff like that. And thresholds are important. Dogs have to wait at thresholds and stuff like that. Mm. And so I think sometimes a little bit in dog training, we throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so while we agree, it doesn't matter who the fuck goes through the door first, right? If you want politeness from the dog and if you want the dog not running out into traffic, sure, teach it to wait at a threshold and to wait for your permission to go through that threshold, not as a dominance play, but as a safety measure for the dog not running out into the street.
Well, that's a good argument for legitimacy on why you would choose a threshold. I mean, one is a fable, the other one is a safety precaution.
Yeah, but so that's what I mean. I think sometimes as we go, well, it doesn't matter who the fuck goes through the door first, but going through a door is still a big deal to a dog. You know, like you get some young dogs and usually can observe this pretty well. If you've got a dog, it's my experience that say was born in someone's garage and has gone from the garage to the backyard and just only that for its first 8 weeks of its life. The first time it goes through a door, it's going to have some hesitation in doing that. Like thresholds seem to hold some level of power to dogs. And so I think that as well, even when dogs are totally fine with the thresholds, it really becomes a something of a portal to the dog, where it's like, no, there's rules for inside and there's completely different circumstances for outside. Mm. And we see that with some dogs, you know, like in the home, like my own dog is like this, but Remy is, he's a completely different dog inside my house or within the confines of my property than he is outside the confines of my property. That threshold is very observable to him, and he's a very different animal on either side of it. And so I think sometimes we take for granted that thresholds still hold a lot of power within dog training, and that if you've got the dog playing inside and all that game is going really well, and then the moment you go outside, the dog isn't interested. Yes, there's the issues of competing motivators. Yes, there's the proofing aspect, like we discussed, in that you've got to be able to bring the dog back into the game, make the game. So in competing motivators, make the game more exciting. Mm. Through doing that, end up with some level of proofing. But then showing the dog that this can go, this, what we've done in this environment can go through to another environment by actually doing it like that, right? Rather than just going like, okay, you can play inside, let's take it outside. Why don't we have the game that now the dog really enjoys start inside, and part of the gameplay is through the door and outside.
Of like, course, absolutely.
That's a super important step.
That's part of the transition.
Yeah.
Just a question on that. As a parent, there are significant ways that have been different in the way that you've raised Rip and Axel, right?
Mm, yeah.
So using the threshold example that you were talking before as a caveat on speaking in that example, I think if I cast my mind back to that episode where we did talk about it, my point was if nothing changes, then why is it a problem?
Mm.
But if something does change, like if there is a change in the behavior of the dog, then there's an identifiable problem.
Mm.
So the caveat that I'm always saying to people, regardless of the advice that you're given, is use your eyes and observe the behavior. Behavior is the tell. Like thinking is not the tell. Behavior is the tell. So for example, if my dog ran inside and I thought, there's a problem when my dog runs in the door before me. Like there is a notable behavioral issue that's arisen from that. Then, okay, I'll address that as that's a threshold issue and I need to change how we address this. Like maybe it is that I need to go in the door before the dog because there's a behavioral difference in the dog. Like when he gets inside, he's a smart ass and he becomes pushy, or he stands there or blocks me in the door, and then something happens as a result of doing all that sort of stuff. Use your brains, use your eyes, like observe the behavior. And again, if you don't know what you're looking at, ask a suitable behavioral trainer, like tell them what's actually going on.
Mm.
Leapfrogging back to that comment you made before, perfect example, like start in the house and move through. Like it doesn't mean that you have to make a big deal of going from one location to another. In fact, the whole point to transitioning is making it so it slides. It's like a gradient that moves. It's not one extreme to the other. It's just flowing from one location into the other, which is another time where I find people make the big difference, and where it does cascade into a problem is because they make it look different. They say complete and utter silence and nothing going on to chaos.
Mm.
So order, structure, limitations to anything goes.
Yeah. And I observed the opposite as well. So like take, for example, you're at a training facility, you have clients park outside, and in the car park, their dog's a total asshole because it wants to get
inside.
There's
other dogs. There's, yeah. They're barking. There's, yeah. But there's movement.
It drags them up to the threshold of your training space.
Yep.
And then comes into there and then dials in completely and goes like, okay, I'm here to do stuff.
Yep.
Or we see the opposite with dogs, you know, doing bite work, right? So like they water ski the handlers. Like in the car park, they might have a level of control, but then they water ski into the facility because the dog's like, well, I'm just here to do bite work. That's all that's happening here. Mm. And that can be fine. Like there's a reason you would do that. But in order to maintain that control, and this is why like Rose's question, I'm sure it relates to a pet dog, but this is the foundation of a lot of decoy neutrality, right? Because if you've got, we say the dog is reactive to other dogs and squirrels, my dog's reactive to decoys and clatter sticks. You know what I mean? Like it's the same thing.
Hmm.
A dog's just drawn to it.
Well, the difference with us is we can quite successfully pre-mac that, where it's difficult where you've got a level of instinct.
Sure, sure, for sure. Mm. That the dog wants to chase those things and you can't allow it to.
Well, we can teach the dog to say, you can have that.
Yeah, yeah.
After you give me like a degree of behavior. So sure. I can pre-mac you through that system.
Sure.
But where the dog has instinctively got a degree of hereditary generations where chasing squirrels and chasing rabbits was in my bloodline, you know, going back to when Adam was a boy. That's very hard. As you and I know, and we've talked about in multiple occasions and with clients and with people who are struggling, some of these dogs, it's live or die on those sort of thing. It's the hill that I'll die on sometimes to give that behavior up. And to what degree you're going to be successful, that really is where I have to answer that by saying it depends.
Mm.
That's how I can best answer that question. It depends. Like, there are so many factors on that that I couldn't just narrow it down to one. Like, I could talk about a range of things and say, we could try this, we could try that, we could do this, we could do that, we could suggest this, and we could give this and as an example to the dog, and we could punish it by doing this, or we could introduce this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that will still be a dependent on actually going out and being trial and error. Like, it really is a trial and error thing. Because, I mean, I can tell you by experience, and you know this yourself because you've done it yourself, to a degree you're successful, but you'll go out there, you'll do it, and you'll think, fuck, that just didn't work as well as I thought it would.
Mm.
In my mind's eye and through the teachings of my mentors or the people that I've seen do it successfully with another dog, it works so well. But what was it with that dog that made it work so well? Why did the dog drop off so easy? Am I dealing with a stronger dog where they were dealing with a weaker dog? Were they using more intensity in their punishes? What was it that actually prevented this from happening? That really does cascade into that bullet point of saying it depends.
Mm. I think the last thing I want to say on it, it fits into everything we've both sort of been saying, but I think that it's much easier to keep a dog's attention than it is to get a dog's attention.
Yes.
And so that's what I mean about dialing the dog in, bringing a consequence for the dog checking out, and that's in the gameplay, right? So like a fun consequence. One of the hang-ups that we have is when we say, you know, pop the dog on the collar or apply some negative reinforcement, people can think about that in like compulsion. And while that is the right word, what I mean by consequence is like, haha, I win. Like, I got you. You should feel something that you didn't perform as well as you're capable of. And that doesn't need to be anything that could demotivate the dog. In fact, it should absolutely motivate the dog to do more. In the same way, you know, if I beat you in chess and I kind of like, haha, got you, I'm not doing that in a way of like, take that, motherfucker, I beat you. I'm doing it in a way of like inviting you to another challenge. I beat you. You need to come back at me and go again. Mm. So by being able to do something like that in the gameplay, get the dog's attention in an environment where you can get the dog's attention, but then use that game, that spiciness, that consequence within the game to keep the dog's attention and start increasing the level of difficulty like that. And that's one of the things, you know, like we see this, we do it all the time, and I'm about to go down to Melbourne, teach an event. Almost certainly a dog like this, I'll see it because I see this kind of dog all the time, is that people will bring the dog from the car. I watch what happens at the car. The dog gets out and is like, hey, what are we doing? And people are just clipping the leashes. They're getting their food and whatever. And they don't do anything with the dog because they're preparing themselves. They bring the dog over to the place where we're all at. And then the dog's like, well, fuck you. You haven't done anything cool for me. I've been with you for 2 minutes. Because they're trying to get the dog to go to the toilet or whatever, right? They're not engaged with the dog. The dog's not engaged with them. The dog comes into the training space, which is probably a dog training facility. And this is probably a weekend, but on Friday, 100 dogs pissed on that floor that are unknown to that dog and now it needs to smell all that. There's 50 to 100 people in the room that the dog now has to either be drawn to or repelled by or just deal with in one way or another. So there's a lot of things vying for the dog's attention, including now the handler who has to try and bring the attention of the dog back to them. Now, of course, we should be able to do that. I can do that. Most people who have their dog dialed in can do that. That's the point. That's the end goal.
We've conditioned for that over a period of time. Like, we've incrementally risen to that.
Yeah. So and that starts out, and this is what I'll do with a young dog, and it's what I do with, you know, not necessarily a young dog, but a dog that hasn't had the level of training, is the moment I open the kennel at the back of the car, I'm engaged with the dog. Hey, man, this is what we're doing. Here's some food. And if that means that I enter the training space, walking backwards, just trickling food to the dog or playing the game, whatever. And if the dog goes to look at somebody and I just give them a little nudge or escape with the game, or I you know, draw them in with a fast moving lure, something like that. If that means that I bring them into that space and I just do a loop of the place and then leave, but the dog stays totally engaged with me, that's a fucking great session. Like, that's the progression to the situation that we want to end up in, where we just open the kennel, the dog goes running out, goes to the toilet by itself. We walk over to the training space. The dog comes over, looks at us, assumes something cool is going to happen. We tell it, yeah, man, let's do something. And the dog has a bias then for action. But I think that's one of the things that people miss, is that the creation of the bias for action when you get the dog out of the car. And so there's so much to be said for bringing the dog through those thresholds, leaving the car, entering the training space, leaving the home, going out into the wild, whatever we're doing, but maintaining the engagement with the dog from where it's easy to get through to where it's difficult to maintain, rather than getting it where it's easy to get, then going, okay, good, got it. Let's go to somewhere where it's less easy to get and trying to bring it back in. It's always going to be more successful. You're always going to have an easier time. And the learning outcome for the dog is going to be clearer when you get the engagement as soon as you can, maintain it as long as you can, and don't go over threshold to the point where you completely lose the dog.
Interesting points and a lot of good validations there on things to think about. Listening to you speaking there, it triggered some thoughts.
It's one that I use quite a lot, like that bringing dogs into the space, because say people get me out or it's my own people, whatever, but the dog is coming in there with a thought on his mind, right? And maybe it's not the right thought. So very often when people come in, maybe the dog's just there to be social with people. Maybe the dog is, because of the training that's happened in that place in the past, has feelings about the place, right? So very often I find myself telling people, like, no, reset, like go back to the car and just get the dog dialed in and now enter the space with the dog dialed in.
In most applications, the first time the dog actually has any form of good feeling or reinforcement is by the stranger who's standing there with a flirt pole or some food in their hand and they're doing some stuff or they're completely ignoring the handler.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an amazing concept. Like when you were talking about that, I had all these things flashing up in my head and I'm thinking, that's something that we don't often discuss in those sort of scenarios because, you know, like you're standing there, you're preparing a seminar, you want dogs to come up and perform for you, but people are like literally water skiing over to you with their dog. And then you're doing a bunch of stuff with them with their dog and their dog's thinking, hey, this guy's far more interesting than you. Like the level of arousal that he creates with me and all these fun, cool games that I'm doing with him or her, I don't do them with you.
Yeah.
I put a clip up the other day on my personal Instagram. I get Randy to do something and I feed him and I got Mando to do something and I feed him and lots of people commented and said, oh, I really love that. They've said, oh, Randy's looking old and blah, blah, blah. He is. He's old man. And one person said to me, can I ask a non-challenging question to you just over watching that clip? I said, of course. And they said, why don't you just let your dogs have a liberated lifestyle? And I said, that question's come up before. I understand why people feel that way, but both these dogs need structure and order in their life. And they also need to understand that what we're doing is actually best for them in the long run. Randy needs it. He needs order and structure. Otherwise, he's completely off scale. So for him, this is the best thing that I can do for him. Like he feels this completes him when I get him to come in and do a little routine with him and then feed him. And I said, with Mando, it's good for him to understand that most things that him and I are doing, I need him to dial into me to understand. Don't just run in the yard and, you know, start hovering around and bullying me for food. I need you to understand, which is a pre-mac principle. I need you to understand if you want this food, I'm guaranteeing you, you're going to have it. I'm going to give you this food once you do something for me. I've never had any issues with my dog. On the contrary, it's always been favorable for me because then they realize I'm not going into the shed to just blast decoys before I do a little trick outside first. I never let my dogs do that. In fact, when I was preparing Randy for PSA 1, I was talking to Casey about this the other day. While you were working other dogs in the shed, I was letting Randy watch that happen while I was doing obedience with him and teaching him to do PSA obedience outside while he was watching you doing the decoy work. And I was letting him that fuel him to be better at his work. In my way, I was whispering to him, son, this is yours. You can have this. But you got to do this for me first. You can't have the dessert unless you eat the broccoli. So for him, eating the broccoli was never a challenge in the end. It never became an issue for him. He just understood, let's just get through the broccoli.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I enjoy the broccoli. The broccoli is just part of the lifestyle. I didn't like it before, you know, because I didn't understand it and I didn't understand that it was the relationship. Like it is part of the pathway. It's not a resistor. It's not something that I have to look at. Like it's causing problems in my life. It's part of the dynamic. It is my life. It's the way things go forward. So for the person that asked me that question, and I appreciated the question, and it makes me think when people ask me that rather than just give a thumbs up, it's nice to talk through some of these concepts with people because it challenges me to think about why I do some of these things myself. But there's method to my madness because I know in the long run it works. And for Randy, he needs it. He needs that stabilization in his mind. Because once I let things start drifting in Randy's mindset and his behaviors, it starts exploding. Like the sides start coming off and everything starts falling apart. For him, as an act of love and compassion for the dog, it's actually better for him to have that structure and that guidance in his life as well. So thanks for the question. That's my answer to it.
It triggers me to think about something I sort of have to remind myself of daily, that I know of dogs and I need to be better at with my kids, right? Is there's so much power, or not necessarily power, that's the wrong word. It's necessary to leave a dog in wanting for a little while.
Because hell yeah.
When they get everything that they want as quickly as they want it, then that to me is a recipe for reactivity. And I think that's where a lot of people, like dogs who can't think clearly, dogs that just cook off when they don't get immediate access to what they want. You know, these are the dogs that are unmanageable on a leash and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, exactly. Like people who know dogs tend to not give their dogs too much for free. Mm. And it's because it doesn't serve the dog. And so, you know, my dogs, for the most part, each day eat from a bowl, you know, like, but there's a process about doing that. I don't ask anything of them, but there's a routine around what it looks like, you know, like as I'm preparing their food, they're in their spots waiting for it. Then they both run out to their kennels and they wait patiently in their kennels as I walk over and give them the food. And all of that was like, there was an element of training to that they're not jumping on me because they both have been really heavily trained with food when they were younger. So I don't like, there's a process of transitioning that from mugging me for it to just going and waiting for it to come to you when they're both loose in the house. But then similarly, like my dog, say Remy with the any kind of ball or any sort of gameplay, whether he wants to play tug with you or just I've got a tennis ball that I'm throwing for him, you know, and there's no interaction between it other than that I pick it up and throw it. Just doing that for him doesn't help him. It doesn't satisfy him really in any way, as well as it's sort of in my experience leads to more reactivity from the dog where the dog is now like doesn't have any impulse control and he sees things and just reacts to them immediately and becomes more and more impulsive and has no ability to sit in idle and want for something and know that there's something that can bring him that thing. And I think that's one of the things that people who are naturally good with dogs tend to do, like just sort of instinctively, is make them do something to get the thing that they're going to get anyway. And you fully intend to give it to them. It's not that you're ever going to hold over Randy's food because he doesn't do the little thing that you ask for him. If he does it stupidly or he does it, you're going to laugh. You're going to tell him to do it again. There isn't really any consequence that's coming if he doesn't do it perfectly.
There's an upside to it all the time.
Yeah, but you're going to let him work through something before you give him something.
Exactly. Solve a puzzle.
Yeah.
Like be part of thinking this through with me, like working with me, like we're not working against each other.
Yeah.
Like what we're trying to do is harmonize.
Yeah.
We talked last week, I used the words being symbiotic or in parallel with each other. But that's fundamentally the relationship that we're trying to forge with our dogs. Even the people that we're teaching about dogs, you know, like we're trying to create a symbiotic relationship where minds are melding together that we can all sit there and go, oh yeah, this is best for us.
Yeah.
Not for me, it's best for us. Likewise, where you're alluding to with this conversation is that when I'm working with my dogs, I'm never thinking about this is just good for me. Like this is a self-licking lollipop scenario. I'm thinking, how do I make your life matter and also make my life matter, but doing it together?
Yeah.
You know, like we're sharing space together. How do I make this work where you don't get frustrated, I don't get frustrated, and both of us enjoy this little moment together, this little pocket of time? How do I make it so there's value in it for both of us?
Yeah.
And the easiest thing, like I said before, is when you understand observable behaviors and you understand what you're looking at and what best outcome serves both of you collectively. And if you're playing that together, you're a wise person. Mm. Like you're actually on the path to ultimate wisdom. It's not to say that I'm an ultimately wise person. There's days where I'm wise and there's days where I'm not so wise. But in those sort of scenarios, I'm thinking this is a great thing for my dog.
Yeah.
And I'm enjoying this with my dog as well. Like both of us are really getting something out of this. I'm not just going in. He's not running rambunctiously around the yard. And then I'm rewarding him accidentally for doing that type of behavior. This is another example this is not just me that said this, like people have said this for eons, is watch what you're rewarding.
Yeah.
You know, like if your dog is, what do they call it, where you jump around off buildings and
parkour,
where your dog is fucking parkouring all around the backyard and you're just watching this behavior and then you put a bowl of food down, that's just marking that behavior.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. Like there's power in coiling the dog up a little
absolutely.
Bit where you just go, 100%. Hey man, you're going to get this, but I need you to just do something. It doesn't matter really what it is. I'm going to ask you to do something. And you're going to have to internalize your desires
yep.
for a short while. And that's like one mental bicep curl
yeah.
for the ultimate heave that has got to come later on. You yep. know what I mean? Like, and I think that's what's important about that kind of stuff. And I caught myself, like, this is high on my mind. We're sort of straying from the topic, but as is the nature of the beast.
But it's an important conversation.
Yeah, it's high on my mind because.
Now it's a conversation for us because I'm enjoying this.
Yeah. Well, it's high on my mind because. Yeah, Rip is a bit of a gamer, right? Yeah. He's into it. And
Minecraft, right?
Well, yeah, at the moment, him and all his buddies are playing Roblox, right? Which I think is like a ripoff of every game. I don't really understand
right.
it. But what I do know is that a while ago, a few months ago, I bought him like a premium Roblox subscription. So it costs me like $9 a month and he gets 440 of these Roblox. So it's like a currency within the game
yep.
and they can upgrade their avatar and buy different weapons that they shoot each other. And he plays with his buddies from school. And
nice.
As much as like I'm careful about the gaming stuff, it's a social thing. That's the world now. So, and he's really into it. And so it's something that I really have to monitor closely because I don't want him becoming that kid that just lives in his iPad,
yep.
but he does have to, that is part of his social circle, right? Like he needs to have an element of that. And so anyway, he's out of Roblox, right? And so he wants to, the issue just yesterday was that one of his buddies has some gun that is just blasting him and he can't fucking compete because he's outmatched by this gun.
Yeah.
And he's out of Robux. He's got no money to buy any upgrades. He can't buy any armor or a better gun or anything like that. And he wanted me to check what day does his subscription renew because he asked me the other day and I had just seen the thing come through and I was like, oh, well, the credit card just got charged. It's the first of the month. So I assume you're about to get it on the first of the month. And then he checks yesterday, it's first of the month and it's not. And so I was like, oh, that's fucking weird. So I get into the settings of his iPad this morning and I realized like, no, we started the subscription on the 16th of the month. So that's when he's going to get his 440 Robux, then he can buy the better gun.
Yep.
So I look and he needs whatever fucking, it was going to cost me like $4 to buy him enough of these fake currency to buy the gun. And I just bought it, right? Like I just, while I was looking at the iPad, I just like hit the thing. And then I was like, oh, I shouldn't have fucking done that. Like that was a stupid thing to do because now he bought it straight away and it doesn't really matter.
He doesn't want for anything now.
Like, yeah, that's a thing, right?
There's no urgency anymore.
Yeah, and it'll be another thing
yeah.
because like the other kids' parents will be like, well, fuck, we'll show them and they'll buy the better gun.
Yeah.
And the problem then just-
always be a one-up instead of a-
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I realized immediately and it, like I was like, I wouldn't, if my dog was like, I need the bowl right now- I'd be like, no, we're going out in half an hour. You have to wait. You have to simmer. Or I would be like, if he was being a total asshole about it, I'd be like, you're going in your kennel, right? Mm. For being like, so I would make the dog, because I know if I give the dog everything he wants, that's not good for him. I know that for a fact, right? Mm. Like I have to restrict him in the things that he wants. He can't get everything that he wants. And in fact, not only is it not good for him, he doesn't like it. He becomes sort of a shittier version of himself when he has too much access to everything. And that's why we always say, don't have all the toys lying around. Keep the special toy, the thing you're going to reinforce the dog with. Like my dog has a Kong in the house or like he's got that big dildo looking thing, the go-nut thing, right? That's the one thing he's never been able to destroy. Yeah, it looks like a giant dildo.
It's
called a go-nut. They make a circular one.
It looks
one.
Like a dildo and it's called a go-nut.
Mate, they make a circular one and they make one that is just a tube and it's an indestructible dog toy and
it's called a go-nut.
It's called a go-nut. I don't even know if the company still exists because they had it. It's a lifetime warranty. Yep. So it's a black toy, but it has a red core. And if you expose any of the red, you post it back to them, they send you a new one. And my dog, he'll cut a black Kong in half. Once he decides, fuck it, I'm chewing through this thing. That takes him about an hour. Once he decides like, this is what's happening.
Yep.
But the go-nut, it doesn't have enough feedback that it's enough for him to happily chew on it, but he's never gone, fuck this thing, I'm destroying it. Like he probably could if he committed to it, but he never has. So right. we've had that, he's had these two go-nuts his whole life, right? They're just in the house. it always gets a weird look when people – I posted a video one time of him just chewing it, and Jerry Bradshaw actually commented, like, what is that? Because it looks exactly like you're imagining.
Yep. And it's called a gonut.
A gonut. Mm. Anyway, so like I remember one time I talked about like the gonut was under the couch and he was trying to get at it. There's two in the house and he doesn't want the one that's available to him. He wants the one that's under the couch.
Yes,
remember that?
The story. Yes,
yeah. So
I do.
Like he doesn't just want everything. He enjoys the act of wanting to want it. And because I've taught him how to feel very comfortable in that state. Now, Mother Nature has a big part in that him being like that. But I've left him to simmer in that he enjoys anticipation and he feels good in that pursuit rather than the have, well, which is what makes him trainable.
If you look at the Sapolsky's model where he talks about the concept of maybe when you're talking about the dopamine cycles, like if you look at how much dopamine you secrete during that time, it's no wonder we pursue that. Like it's no wonder you feel more happiness during that time, or not so much happiness, but you actually are getting a physical burst of dopamine. Because that's actually happening to you when you introduce the concept of maybe. Like, and you can't have it now. You have to wait for things.
And you'll get it later. And that's exactly what I realized I stole from Rip when I was like, oh, I'll just buy them. Like, I've got $4. Like, I can, although I can easily afford to buy you $4 to buy a better gun to shoot your kid, this other kid, like for sure, I'm happy to do that. And then the moment I did it, I was like, oh, fuck, shouldn't have done that. Because he was super thankful. He was really happy. He immediately bought it, blasted that kid, and then was like, oh, like job's done, you know? Whereas I left him, it's another 2 weeks of him having to figure out him getting killed by this other kid all the time, him having to get probably better at the game, get better at strategy. Like I feel like I robbed him of something that he would have been better off had I not bought the thing for him.
I know we have strayed off topic, so I'm going to continue with that trend. Do you know anybody who's come from a genuinely rich family who is a trust fund baby?
Yeah.
I know of someone through a colleague of mine, like genuinely came from a very, very rich, privileged family. Mm-hmm. They were basically the epitome of a trust fund baby. So if you look at the movie, The Talented Mr. Ripley, and you see Jude Law, who plays that, he's trying to find himself in Europe and living this very liberated, spoilt life. Mm. This person was the epitome of that sort of character as well. Like anytime they got in trouble, daddy's money would bail them out.
Yeah.
Very much a privileged lifestyle. Until it all ended and basically the banks moved in and foreclosed. This happened quite some time ago, but the minute everything was removed, that person's life ended up in fucking turmoil, like drug addiction, sad, very sad, you know, drug addiction, jail, lots and lots of problems, like went from a person who actually was a very intelligent person. And most people that I know that knows the person said, I won't say the name, this particular person could have been a world beater, like had an intelligence level that far surpassed everybody else, like ideas, thoughts, concepts. But because they got everything when they wanted it, boats, cars, access, houses, privilege that nobody else really got, and shared it with people. I'm not saying that they'd pie everyone in the face with it, but had a good time with it. But while dad's money was bailing them out all the time, it was all great. Mm. As soon as it ended, they couldn't stand on their own feet. Mm. Like their life literally just collapsed around them. And I've seen evidence of that. I've seen it in dogs before where everything is done for them. The dogs are basically pandered to. And when the dog has to stand on its own, you just see the dog's world collapsing around it. It's not as intense because dogs are far more malleable than people. You know, like they seem to have a bounce back button that people don't seem to have. They don't really depress the same way that people do, at least to my knowledge and what I've observed before. But interesting concept. I know this person. I've seen the second half of their life, not the first half of their life. But it does make me think, because this is not the first person I've heard that story about before. There are other people who have, I don't know if you've witnessed it yourself. I don't know if you've seen similar circumstances, but it's an interesting concept that when everything is given to you, when you want it, how you want it, you don't seem to have the same sort of metal in your life or the same sort of grit or the same capability to work through
those of us
who have to wait and those of us who have to change tactics and those of us who have to think on our feet.
No, absolutely. And I think that impulse control.
That was the point I was trying to make. Yeah, impulse control. Yeah,
impulse control or resilience or, you know, all those things. Like there's a genetic component to that, but the genetics determines the bandwidth, not the amount. And then the amount has to be built. It's one of the things, you know, we constantly say it. Like the example, I was actually about to post a reel about it the other day. It's like hanging from a bar. When you're getting a dog to hold it down, right, and he understands the process of holding it down and knows that there's reinforcement that can come for having done it and there's some sort of aversive consequence that can come for not doing it, there still is only so much of it that he can do in the face of something that is trying to draw him out of the down. So, like, you know, like in you know, dog training terms, you say that the dog wants to chase birds and you've taught the dog to down appetitively and he loves doing it and he's happy to do it in conditions being right. And you've taught him, hey, you have to, there's a consequence for leaving. Even with both of those things, there's still a limit to how long he can physically do it because that is the same way that if I get you to hang off of a chin-up bar, you can only hang for so long before like the amount of whatever it is, like ATP within your fingers that actually is powering the muscles to hang on expires and you cannot do it any further. And it's that's the same thing with impulse control and resilience. There hits a point where you cannot, and you can punish that dog as much as you want. It isn't going to change the fact that he wasn't able to do it in that moment. And he'll need more repetitions. And that's why we do things slowly. It's why we build. Like in every sport that has a period of time long down, nobody just goes, oh, I taught the dog to down. He could down for 4 seconds. Let's go to 2 minutes. Mm. You know what I mean? Like we know that. We have to build the progression because you got to teach that dog impulse control. Hey, man, I need you to keep it together for a second. Cool, got it? Now I need you to do it for 2 seconds, right? Cool. And we build it like that. Nobody just goes like, oh, you're going to hold this position. Nobody worth their shit forces a dog to do something for a longer period than they're capable of doing. That's what's built. Like all of that is built in the like, hey, just sit there until I get your food ready. Here's your food, right? Like it's the rehearsal of that. Every one of those is one of the chin-ups that is needed to be able to hang from the bar for a period of time later on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeez, we went a little while on that one.
We did. We went almost 50 minutes.
Let's just do one more.
One more. We'll do one more.
We've got to go and train some real dogs.
Yes.
Nick Musket says, Nick's a top, Rosa is as well. They're top contributors.
Thank you, Nick and Rosa.
Yep. Facebook tells us they're top contributors.
Well, this is actually fun reading from the requests of our listeners. So instead of us just wailing on about a topic that we think is interesting, like this is we're interacting with our audience.
You know what's funny? So like once a month I do something similar to this in Patreon, right? And it's usually there's between 14 to 17 questions and I go for 2 hours and I usually get them all done in the 2 hours.
Yeah, nice.
But there's no feedback. It's just me talking to people who are watching. There's, you know, there's usually 20 odd people watching live, but they can't interact with me, right? So it's just me talking. Whereas when it's you and I just bouncing back and forth, like I still manage to get myself derailed. Don't worry about that. Like I still manage to go on some weird tangents without your influence. But when it's us, we're lucky to get through two questions in an hour.
But I'm a good derailing influencer.
All right, Nick says, I'd like to hear what you guys think of the idea of pre-fatiguing a dog before a more technical training session to let a little steam off before asking them to focus. And I think, Nick, that is a wonderful question.
It is.
And what I think of that is I don't think of it like certainly I've used the term pre-fatiguing. I have used that for sure.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, what I mean and what I do is bring the dog into the level of arousal that serves me for the session.
Yep.
And so sometimes that is literally pre-fatiguing the dog and getting the dog tired. It's one of the things, especially as I work with, say, military working dogs, for example, with outing issues, right? Yep. So you get some pretty extreme dogs that have had a lot of different training put into them. They're very tough to pressure. Some of those dogs can be very difficult to get to out, no matter what tool you want to use on them along the way, right? And so when I get called in to address an issue like that, one of the first things I do is put the dog on the table and let it bite me for probably 20 minutes or more. And so one of the things I tend to do, especially in a situation like that, is I bring the dog into a level of arousal that serves me for the session. So if I'm trying to teach a dog to let go of something and the dog has become obsessive with biting it, and the dog, say, all the tools of compulsion have become tools of action for the dog, like it sees all the pressure as do harder, stronger, deeper. Yeah, all those things aren't going to help me. The thing that's going to help me is get the dog fucking tired to the point where the dog's thinking, geez, I wish someone would tell me to let go of this thing. Because like, I don't have the neural circuitry to make that decision for myself. I'm going to stay in this fight as long as I possibly can. But then I will just let the dog bite. Like, no pressure, not even fighting, congratulating the dog on doing a great job, working it just around in circles on the table for usually at least 20 minutes. And then the dog is very fatigued. And when you tell him to out, the process of having a little rest before you get him to re-engage is the reinforcer. So the out then becomes self-reinforcing because the dog's like, oh, thank God. Like, I'm actually—
You don't have any of that conflict going on.
Yeah. I'm actually happy that I've got a moment where this isn't happening. We're not fighting. So like, there's no pressure. You know, you shouldn't be concerned about me as the decoy or whatever. But I'm just going to let you sit and feel comfortable for a few moments with the out, and then you can go back in. Yep. We'll go another few minutes and then I'll give you another little rest. In doing it that way, yes, I am pre-fatiguing. Certainly in that instance, I'm going to call that pre-fatiguing. And that's a time where I would even explain to the handler or whoever I'm training with, like, this is my intent. I'm going to pre-fatigue the dog. But the truth is, although I am pre-fatiguing, what I'm actually doing is bringing the dog to the level of arousal that serves me. And so in my own training sessions, I do the same. Like, most of the time, if I'm going to train a dog, like, you know, and I've got a dog that I've dialed in, so the motivation's there, I've got a pretty high level of arousal, I'm then going to modulate my session to have the levels of arousal that my dog will go through, because that's going to change throughout the session. I'll have those levels of arousal serve me throughout. So if I'm teaching something new and my dog comes into the session and he's, you know, full of power and he's like, hell yeah, I want the things, I'm here to do stuff. Well, that's probably not the best time to teach something new. That's the best time to proof something and be prepared for it to fail. Like, I want in my proofing phase, I want the dog to fail 2 out of 10 times. That's flow state. If the dog's always successful, now there's layers to failure. I don't want like the dog to totally shut down and not understand what's happening, but I want—
No, it's randomized. So yeah, it's like binary.
What I want is that the dog's draw to its own reinforcer provides conflict between doing the work that I'm asking him to do to earn that reinforcer,
it's learning, not failing,
versus just wanting to get the reinforcer. And I want to control that. 8 out of 10 times, I want to have to help the dog to be correct. Because if I correct every time, I'm not really training, I'm just rehearsing, right? Yeah. I'm not progressing, I'm maintaining. So I want the dog to be intermittently unsuccessful. So I'll use that level of arousal that wouldn't serve me if I'm trying to teach the dog something new. I use that high level of arousal at the start of the session to proof something. I reinforce the dog a couple of times. I make the dog be successful in that. And then in doing that, I will have lowered the level of arousal because the dog's had a couple of repetitions. It's won the thing. It's eaten the food, whatever it is that we're doing. That's going to bring the dog down a notch. And now the dog can think. And so now I'm like, okay, I've brought you to the level of arousal that serves me for this next phase in the session.
Yep.
And then I might, at the end of the session, again, determining the dog's level of arousal, choose how I'm going to finish. Am I going to completely satiate the dog in the session because the dog did great? Or am I going to leave the dog a little bit hot? Am I going to leave the dog wanting a little bit more? There can be all, like, there's lots of different ways I'm going to end the session. I think it's in the Patreon. I have a whole video on how to end a session, like why, and there's a lot of different thought processes on that. You famously have the saying like, no more, one more time. There's the idea of finish on a win. There's lots of all these different things. And like, I have a whole video, it's in the Patreon, on how to bring all that together. Like, practically, what does that mean? And what it comes down to is, at the end of the session, how do I want the dog to feel about this session?
That's one of the most important things about student training, is the student always should feel better at the end of the session than they did at the beginning.
Yeah, that has some quantifying about it as well. You know what I mean? Like, feel better for what we want to achieve, not necessarily feel
so
better.
There's an extension
full
to that. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They still should be in a better frame of mind. Like, what happened? Like, I guess at the end of it is, did I get a handle on that? Like, do I understand what happened there? Making this about guitars again. I did a guitar session. I'm working with a mentor at the moment because largely I've been teaching myself online. Like, I've been threatening to get serious about this for a while, not for any other reason. It's just for myself. I'm still a closet guitar player. I still consider myself very much a novice, but I'm into it. Like, I like it and I like the feeling of it. I like learning and sounding better, and it means something to me. And I did a session with the guy that I'm training with. He's a young fella called Jake. He's a pretty talented musician. I finished the session not really feeling good about the session because I was more confused about the session than when I went into it. And it left me in a bit of a dark hole, as it normally does. And I was kind of thinking on it when I got home. I thought, this is exactly how I don't want a dog to finish a training session. Yeah, right.
There you go.
Like, I got perspective right there, right then. I thought, this is not what I want to do when I'm training someone to learn or when I'm training a dog. It wasn't his fault. It was my fault. I was asking so many questions towards the end there that I confused myself and we ran out of time. And he just said, mate, look, sorry, like, I've got another student waiting. We'll have to take this up next session. So when I went in there, what I said to him is, before we begin, let me just tell you the dilemma it left me in last week. I said it left me in a bit of a dark space where I didn't really want to play guitar that week because I was so frustrated about what happened. And he goes, oh, yeah, I'm sorry about that, man. And I said, no, it's not your fault. It's actually my fault for hammering you. And he goes, oh, I actually was thinking about ringing you during the week because I sort of saw you becoming frustrated and anxious about what we're doing. And I said, yeah, what I need to do when we finish is I need to make sure that I've got clarity on what we're doing. I need focus and deliberation on what actually happens here at the end of the lesson. I can't leave that way again. It's not good for my mental health. And he said, done. So let's make sure that we leave 5 minutes to have an end of the session where we do like a bit of a warm down, so to speak. So if you do have questions or there's something that I don't have to, you know, like rush you out the door or anything like that. And he said, because that's important to me as well. He goes, I'd rather the session end like that. So for me, it gave me perspective about lots of things that students encounter when they're sort of like, okay, time's up. We've just got to go. And you're left with nothing to conclude with there, you know? So then you start thinking alternative dark thoughts. That might not be for everybody. And what I want to do is circle back to the question, the original question, which you did a terrific job of answering. So I'm not going to add too much more to that other than to say it depends on the dog and it depends on the behavior.
Yeah, yeah, so exactly. Like everything.
Yes. There's times where people have come to me for dog aggression things and they've said to me, should I run the dog or should I do this or should I do that? And there's been times where I've said to the client, no, I want to see the dog roar. I want to see the dog with all the power and the energy. I need to see the behavior. Come in, show me what the dog's doing. I need to see it. There's been other times where I've said, yes, you need to do that. I need the dog dissipated a little bit. I need some of that lightning into a jar. So when the dog comes in, we've got something to work with. And I said, because the dog is literally leaping off the walls when it gets here. It always depends on the dog and it depends on the behavior, on what I will advise the student to do or even what I'll do with my own dogs in any given sort of situations. There are some times where, like you said, I do need to cycle the dog down. I do need to remove a little bit of that edginess that the dog has just to get the dog back into a state of mind. Jake, my teacher, he did the same thing to me. I went in there and I was, you know, like he's talking to me and I'm strumming things down. And he said, hey, Tiger, just chill. He goes, I'm trying to talk to you. We'll get into this in a minute.
Yeah.
He goes, I need your head for a bit of space. And I said, sorry, man. He goes, just jam a bit. You and me just jam for 5 minutes and then I need your head.
Yeah.
So he just saw I needed that. So we did. We just jammed. We just sat there and we just jammed out. And he goes, all right, feel better? And I said, yeah, I feel good now. And he goes, all right, cool. You're a teacher. You know how important this is. And I said, yeah, but I've got things on my mind at the moment. And it was hard just coming straight out of work and into this. I just kind of needed to have that little spin off.
Yeah.
And he goes, cool. So before we do our sessions, why don't you just tell me that? And we'll do that if that's important to you. We'll spin our wheels for 5 minutes and then we'll get into the lesson so we can make it about learning. And I said, deal, done. So for me and him, it was just about clarifying communication between the two of us. Like, we had to sort of get into each other's mindset. He needed to understand me and I needed to be understood so we could develop the lesson between us. To circle back to my point, it depends on the dog and it depends on the behavior. And sometimes it just depends on the day.
It's interesting to hear you say that. Like, we often don't think of warming the dog up. You know, in a session, maybe you will warm the dog up physically. Like, you might do the, you know, go for a walk or put them on like whatever to get their body moving so they're not getting injured. But also I think just in sort of prepping them for the session, you know, and doing that appropriately. So, you know, one of the things I'm usually pretty careful of when I say to people like, okay, let's warm the dog up. what I often mean by that is, like, let's get the dog in the habit of being reinforced in the way that we're about to reinforce the dog for the thing we're about to teach it.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're going to teach a dog to send away, for example, like if you're teaching a dog to go out to do something, bringing the dog in and dialing it in heavily on you is not going to be helpful for that session.
Yeah.
Right. So bringing the dog in and throwing some food and getting the dog running away from you or throwing the ball or whatever it is, like creating a draw away from your own expectation of good things are happening away, is the way to warm the dog up mentally for, like, okay, well, now we're going to be doing sendaways. There's a lot of external reinforcers that you've built this expectation of that. It's going to be much easier to teach the dog that rather than dealing with the conflict of the dog being more inwardly focused while we're trying to teach an outwardly focused sort of thing.
Mm.
And I think winding a dog down can be important or not important, right? It can be important to sometimes put a dog away hot. Like, you know, take, for example, just a club. We've got, say, Dom's dog, for example. We most of the time finish with, like, some kind of satiation bite because the dog's never actually ever very satiated.
Mm.
So it does well for the dog to just let him, you know, the decoy sits in a chair and the dog just gets to download into him for, you know, a good 5 minutes or something like that after it's done a really good session. But then we've got other dogs that if you did that, then the next session would be dog shit because the cup is full because it has a shallow cup.
Mm.
Whereas some dogs' cups are, you know, it's a much bigger cup. It's much harder to fill or it empties quicker. So, like, I think exactly as you said, knowing the outcome that you want and knowing the dog and what's going to work for the dog. But I mean, that's a very long answer for yes, I do absolutely consider the arousal level of the dog and bring that arousal level to what is going to serve me for what I'm trying to achieve in the session.
I think before you conclude that, you should do a little bit of a summary. Read the room.
Mm.
You know, when a dog and a handler come into a room, that's if you have the capability to do that. Like, sometimes people are asking, what do I do? Like, when I'm with my dog, like, what do I do? The reason they're asking that question is they don't know.
Mm.
There's a lot of things I learn as being a very basic novice musician, someone who spent most of my life not being a musician, that I'm learning new things about myself. Sometimes I'm sitting in the room here by myself thinking, I've got no one to ask this question to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, there's no set of eyes upon me right now where somebody's going, oh, no, move your hand here. Or the reason that you can't fret like that is because your elbow is in the wrong place, which is what something Jake showed me the other day when I was doing the lesson with him. He said, mate, why don't you move your elbow here? I thought, holy fucking shit. For the last 2 years, I've been doing it this way and this is why my hand cramps up and this is why it feels so horrible. And he goes, yeah, move your elbow like this. Like,
that's the power of a coach, right?
Yeah, the power of a coach, like somebody who's there. But when you don't have that, you'll do what you think is the best thing to do until someone says, why are you doing it that way? Can I suggest something which alleviate a lot of that problem that you're having there? Something that you've struggled with for a long period of time. And I appreciate Nick asking that question because there have been so many times where we answer questions for ourselves that aren't anywhere near the accuracy that it demands.
Mm.
And that's because you're left with your own devices. You've got no one there to bounce it off, which is why it is very important to have, I guess, have a tribe around you.
Yeah.
Have people that can give you feedback and show you what it looks like. We've said some simplistic things about filming yourself sometimes, like looking back and seeing, what do I actually look like? What does my posture look like when I'm doing these sort of things?
Yeah, for sure.
I remember in the very early days of training for Schutzen and so forth, a lot of times we used to film each other because you'd be surprised how many times your neck was crooked in the wrong way, your shoulder carriage would be making the dog lag behind you, all sorts of things like that.
Mm.
Like, the question is asked, why does this happen? Why am I doing this? Because you're teaching that way and you're reinforcing for it as well.
Yeah.
Your original response to that was terrific.
Well,
let's leave it there.
I think that's it.
Yes, it is.
For another episode of Counter Paradigm. As always, like what you hear.
Yes.
Just tell someone about
it. Do that.
Like, rate, share.
Why not?
Do all those things.
Do it.
I think we've discussed it many times. The very best way to share that you like the show is to do it on a bus, put your AirPods into somebody else's ear.
We haven't done that for a while.
I think probably the best way to prove that you enjoy the show is with an 80s style boombox over your shoulder, just blaring it as you walk down the street. That's probably the best way to do it. But, you know, you could just get into iTunes and just give us a little review there and just say, hey, I really like the show.
It's not as much fun as just, like, sticking your earwaxy ear pod in somebody's ear.
It's not.
There's nothing that says, dangerous. Hey, I dig you. Like putting a dirty ear pod in somebody else's ear.
If you want to support the show, the best way to do that is to jump into Patreon. Yep. A few bucks a month can get you extra episodes in there. I put stuff in there.
A few bucks. Come on. Daddy needs some Apple Vision Pros.
I got an interesting message about the Apple Vision Pros from somebody today.
Yes.
I'll show you after this.
Lovely.
Yep. You just triggered my memory, actually. So
very good. Very
to
good.
The listener that sent me that. Thank okay. you. Wonderful. So, yep, that's happening.
If you want to support our new studio that we're planning to build.
Yeah, one day. Yep.
Like this mecca that we're trying to build. If you want to be on board with that, if you want to be a... like a direct Patreon to that, and you're just thinking, look, I've got a lazy million just sitting in my bank account.
Do you know what? After we discussed this last time, I thought about it. $2 million wouldn't buy us, like here in Sydney, $2 million wouldn't get us anything like what we were describing.
It'd get us a ramshackle.
Yeah, it wouldn't buy us anything like what we were talking about. It's disgusting. We're like, yeah, get a mad facility, we'll make heaps of cool content around it.
Yeah.
We couldn't, like for $2 million, we wouldn't get that.
Yep.
Not in Sydney, not a fucking chance.
Not in Sydney, no. Yeah.
My house, like many of the listeners have seen video of like within my postage stamp size house.
Mm-hmm.
My house is worth $2 million.
Yeah.
That's fucking insanity.
Mm-hmm.
It's madness. Sydney. All right. Yeah. So give us $2 million. We'll get $2 million each.
We'll go to Guam and find a place.
Yeah. No, $2 million each would get us a
$2 million each. Nice, yes. $2 million each. Yeah, like if
I suppose we could rent one. $2 million would get us a few years rent.
Oh yeah, you could get some wicked rent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, we'll do that. We'll rent it.
Okay.
All right, so $1 million each. The other thing is get some t-shirts. Get into spring. It's links in the description. You'll be able to get yourself.
Yeah, buy 2 million t-shirts.
Yeah, I would suggest just give us the money directly rather than buy us 2 million t-shirts. It seems unnecessary.
Yes,
there's a lot of that's going to end up with a lot of t-shirts people don't need. There's a lot of t-shirts.
Who
in the
says
drawer.
They don't need it? Who says?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Who am I to judge?
Like 2 million t-shirts. Like think of all the cool cash that we could get, and that's 2 million people that could be wearing our merch.
What do we get about $8 a shirt or something
I think
like
so.
That?
So it's like $16 million.
Yeah, we're killing it. All
so
right.
You've just thrown away $16 million and the possibility of people wearing. Like, you know, 2 million people out there in the public.
Just fitting out all of New Zealand.
Exactly.
In our merch. All right, so do that. If you want to get in touch with us, best way to do that is to jump into the Facebook discussion group. That's a really cool group. We try to stay on top of the info in there, and that's where all these questions that we're doing this from, that's where that's all come from.
Yep.
And if you want to contact us directly, best way to do that is to shoot us an email. We are info@thecanineparadigm.com. Love you all. Goodbye.